Hey guys, Marta here from Political Theater. Just want to let you know that today's episode has a lot of discussion about domestic violence and sexual assault. People who are younger or survivors of sexual assault and domestic abuse might want to sit this one out. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hey Marta, do you want to record a podcast episode with me?
What? No. No.
No?
No.
Well, why not?
I don't know because I don't want to.
All right, you left me leave me no choice then.
Whoa! Hey! What are you doing?
I'm gonna ask you one more time. Will you or will you not record a podcast episode with me?
Oh my God!
My hand's slipping.
Okay, fine, fine. I will record a podcast episode with you if you get down from there.
Don't do me any favors.
No, really, I want to.
Say it.
I want to record a podcast episode with you.
Say it again.
I want to record a podcast episode with you.
All right. We'll record a podcast episode. Jeez.
Seriously?
Discuss pop culture narratives and real life politics. I'm Martin R. Schneider.
And I'm Marta Russick.
And if you didn't recognize it, we just did a actual scene from The Notebook. Literally.
Worst movie ever.
Not the worst ever, but it's pretty bad.
It's up there. It's bad.
Literally, we literally just took out the phrase go out with you and replaced it with record a podcast episode. Mm-hmm. But in that scene, Ryan Gosling is just meeting Rachel McAdams' character, and he's climbing on a Ferris wheel and threatening to drop off. He's threatening to jump off if she doesn't agree to go out with him.
Right. Which, by the way, do not attempt that in real life. Don't do it.
For a number of reasons.
Yeah, totally.
And so we're going to talk about that today. Like, why is that a bad idea? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily climbing onto... that one's obvious. It's obvious why it's a bad idea to climb up a Ferris wheel and threaten to drop. But why is it a bad idea to date the kind of person that would climb on a Ferris wheel and almost drop themselves off in order to date you?
Right, because unfortunately, that was an example of an unhealthy relationship. In healthy relationships, you respect the boundaries of another person or meet them where they're at, and you don't try to convince them, you don't try to force them into coming around to your way of thinking, rather. But there's a mutual respect and a willingness to let the other person be who they are and embrace their individuality. So that's what we're going to talk about today. The portrayal of unhealthy relationships in mainstream media and why that's important to talk about.
And also why it's romanticized. Because mm-hmm. that scene is played very, very romantically. And it's something that I think a lot of people have seen, especially when they were teenagers, and swooned over.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because it's Ryan Gosling. I used to believe in what I called the Ryan Gosling effect.
Oh, here we go.
Which is that every Ryan Gosling movie features Ryan Gosling doing something that would be completely unacceptable if a person who is not as good looking or charming as Ryan Gosling did it.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm older, I seem to think that even when somebody that good looking does it, it's still not acceptable.
Being sexually harassed is the worst. I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. Being sexually harassed by an ugly guy is the worst. If he's hot, it's just plain old flirting. No one's ever been like, get away from me, you model. Like, that's fine. It has to do also with an unrequited, uninvited sexual energy. And women are very aware of that. Every woman in here knows what it feels like to have a guy's eyes on you when you find him attractive. It's the best feeling. When you see like a group of hot guys and you walk by and your head, you're like, hope they're looking at my butt. Feels so good. Feel so good about my little haunches right now. And when the dudes are gross and you have to walk by, you're like, please don't look at my butt. Please don't look at my butt. Please don't look at my butt. Don't look at it.
Oh, please let those hot construction workers look at me. All right. So that was a clip that we just heard from comedian Eliza Schlesinger talking about, you know, the eye of the beholder, so to speak.
Context matters, I guess. And to be fair to Eliza, we cut that off. She does kind of go on to talk about sexual harassment and as being a horrible thing.
Yes.
And the unwanted advances that it puts on women and the horrible position it puts women in when they're just trying to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking today because when we first came up with this idea, it was right around Valentine's Day. A new Fifty Shades of Grey movie was coming out. It's still in theaters right now.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of us saw it because we both put ourselves through the first Fifty Shades movie.
Right. And we both value our sanity enough that we didn't want to inflict further pain or damage.
So we'll be talking about that today. We're going to talk about movies like Twilight. We're going to talk about
Fifty Shades.
And to be clear, this is not just targeted at women. We're going to talk about how the effect that these movies have on men in our perception of relationships and how to handle them.
Before we get started, we have a couple of conditions that we'd like to go over really fast.
Our contract with you, as you will.
Exactly. So the first thing I want to mention is we're going to be talking about domestic violence and sexual assault. We did mention this at the top of the show, but one more time, if you are a survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence and these conversations are triggering, please press the stop button now and walk away. Some other time we'll pick up this conversation.
Second, the films and the relationships we're going to be talking about today are super heterosexual. This isn't really intentional. We're not trying to leave anybody out. The problem is there just aren't that many queer relationships shown in the mainstream that we can talk about yet. We might deal with that on a different episode.
The last thing we want to be careful to emphasize, we are not kink shaming. Whatever kink it is that you have, that is your choice. You are awesome for it. We're just talking about the dark side.
And we're also going to point out that there's nothing wrong with loving the movies and television shows that we're talking about that may show unhealthy relationships. We're going to talk about some things that we like.
Absolutely.
That just have some problematic elements to it.
But we want to emphasize the stuff about these particular pieces of pop culture phenomena that might be unhealthy or sending messages that are mixed or just plain not cool.
And why are we even talking about this? Why is it super important that we have this discussion and not just say, oh, it's just a movie, we can just let it go, people can tell fact from fiction? Well, to help us with that, here's Jesta Mokos, who is an instructor of human sexuality at Purdue University.
When it comes to relationships, we learn the rules of the road through observation. So we develop these deeply ingrained social scripts that dictate things like who pays on the first date or how long it should take you to get over a breakup or what it takes to help a partner orgasm. Definitely, we get some of that information from the people around us, right? We see our parents' marriages or family or friends or whatever, but a lot of it, especially in this day and age, comes from movies and television media and books, I suppose, but to a lesser extent because who reads books anymore, right? So my definition that I like and that I teach to folks is that consent is an active process. It's a process of informed and enthusiastic agreement to participate in something. So in this case, we're probably talking about sexual or romantic activity with another person. Consent is usually shown as being given by not opting out of something, but I like to teach people to opt in rather than just remain silent and not opt out. I teach folks that consent is the presence of yes, not the absence of no.
In terms of 50 Shades, we're talking about sexual consent. We're talking about consent to do things that are maybe outside of the comfort zone of one party, which is, there's nothing wrong inherently with that. But it can also be used in other ways. There's such a thing as romantic consent. We talked about the Ferris wheel scene in The Notebook, which we just reenacted.
Mm-hmm.
That's coercion. And somebody who is coerced into saying, yes, I would like to go out with you, doesn't actually really want to go out with you. They are being forced to do so under certain circumstances.
And if somebody's doing that to you before you've even gone out with them, run, because that's an indication that they are probably going to be doing that quite a bit to you when you're actually in a relationship. And it's one of those things, we're actually talking a lot about consent with my 12-year-old nephew. He's not even at the age where he's really dating yet, but we emphasized to him, you know, I said that I didn't want to do that, and you kind of went ahead and said, well, we're going to be doing this. We're trying to emphasize to him now that by respecting somebody's boundaries, it could protect you later so that A, you're not hurting somebody's feelings, and B, you are not breaking the law, because if you're forcing somebody into having sex or performing a sex act when they clearly don't want to, that's illegal and it's evil and wrong.
I mean, in terms of children, it's literally just as simple as soon as they're not having fun, you have to stop. If somebody says you don't want to play, they don't want to play.
Yeah.
Done.
And you don't coerce them. You don't say, oh, but you'll really like it if you just give it a chance. You just say, great, we'll go play another game.
There's none of that, you know, Marty McFly, what are you, chicken kind of thing.
Exactly.
That's another way that, you know, people are coerced into doing things. They're called out on their fears. So coercion is one potential for abusive behaviors.
Right.
And it's something that we do see in movies a lot. It's a form of abuse.
Right. And there's actually several different kinds of abuses. The one that we seem to see glorified in movies about survivors of domestic violence is the physical violence. Like, I walked into a door, or, you know, a broken arm, or things of that nature. But abuse can be financial, meaning somebody takes your paychecks, they give you an allowance, they make you beg for the money that you need to go buy groceries or take care of your children together. There's digital abuse. You send a picture of yourself without any clothes on to somebody that you care about, and then when you break up, they submit those pictures to a website without your consent in an effort to intimidate or harass you or punish you for leaving them. There's also emotional abuse. Again, there are different types of abuses where nothing physical actually has to happen. It's just the idea of one person dominating another and not letting equal shares of that relationship be recognized.
And in 50 Shades of Grey, they take that big D in BDSM, which stands for domination, and they apply it to everything.
Spoiler alert, domination is abuse.
But not necessarily in the, like, context of a BDSM relationship. It's entirely possible to have a kinky relationship with consent.
And what was interesting is when 50 Shades, the book, first came out, there was a huge outcry from the BDSM community on how inaccurate this portrayal of a relationship was. Because in the BDSM community, there's a huge emphasis on, you know, when you tie somebody up, when you whip them. When you engage in these behaviors, you're literally taking somebody's life into your hands.
Once again, Jestimokos.
Educate yourself constantly. I think a lot of people make the mistake of seeing a movie like 50 Shades of Grey, for example, and going out and buying all the gear without doing any research into how to do it safely. In the kink community, there's a big focus on risk awareness. And what that means is making sure that you understand the damage and the danger that is inherent in whatever you're doing. That's part of what makes it fun, right, is that there's some risk to it, but it's important to educate ourselves. Exploring our fantasies and bringing them to life is amazing, and it's worthwhile, but it takes work, and it's important to mitigate risk as much as possible, particularly if we're playing something with something that has an air of danger to it. Another huge problem with that movie is not only the representations of, frankly, an abusive relationship, but the reinforcement of the concept that you can't have sexual diversity and interest in kink without being abused or being broken in some fashion. His whole background is he was abused by an older woman when he was younger, and that's why he is the way he is, which is just fucking ridiculous. It's not true. Normal people are kinky. It's totally fine. Whatever weird, fucked up shit you're into is totally normal and healthy and natural, as long as everyone involved is consenting and being as safe as possible.
So, of the movies that we talked about and watched to prepare, I think 50 Shades might be the only one that's actually still relevant. Like, The Notebook is like 10 years old. I don't know if people still read or watch Twilight anymore. But there is currently a 50 Shades movie out. So let's talk about the first one.
Yes, let's.
In terms of quality, I'm just going to throw it out here. That movie is so boring.
Yes. Well, even the sex scenes aren't that sexy. And you were telling me before we came in here that they actually toned a lot of stuff down and took a lot of stuff out getting to the movie.
Well, what I heard was like they toned down a lot of the stalkery parts. Like Christian Grey is much more stalkery in the books than he is in the movie. And he's pretty stalkery in the movie.
Well, there's a scene where he, in my notes I had said that, you know, 30 minutes into the movie, he's picking out her outfits for her. He's following her around. He's showing up unannounced at her job, at her house. He has a car picking her up. He's basically dictating, where are you going? What are you doing? And he says at one point, you're here, like in his hotel room when he wakes up with her the next day, you're here because I'm incapable of leaving you alone.
Yeah, like there's a huge control thing happening here where he keeps tabs on her every move. And he tracks her phone, and he's allowed to do these things basically because he's rich and because she's kind of into him a little bit, but he's also much older than she is, which is a common theme with these.
Spoiler alert, I personally enjoy going out with older men, so we are definitely not knocking older men in any way, shape, or form
again,
in this episode.
Like nothing wrong with that, but there's a huge difference between like the experiences of a 20-year-old college senior versus a 35-year-old billionaire who's well traveled.
Right.
Like it's enough to make you raise an eyebrow.
Exactly. Well, it does touch on that idea of, well, because he's rich, like somehow being rich gives you the ability to do things that us middle class or working class individuals just can't do.
It's part of the fantasy.
Yeah.
Like the rich white knight to sweep you off your feet, but this case it's a little better because he's troubled. There's a little bit dark. It's Byronic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this goes all the way back to like Wuthering Heights. This is basically Heathcliff,
the brooding guy that needs to be rescued from himself.
Right. And this is not a new trope. It's
right.
been romanticized and considered for a long time. Now I will say this: after slogging through 50 Shades of Grey, and I mean slogging because literally nothing happens in the middle hour of that movie. All of the conflict happens in the first 30... No, everything plot-wise happens in the first 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And then I actually have a note where I wrote down, it's been 90 minutes and there's been no real conflict in this movie. We just have an hour of, like, Cinemax, basically.
Pretty much. It's like it's a pornographic movie where you don't actually see the sex acts, you see the hints of it.
Yeah, sex... Porn is free. Like, you can get porn for free on the internet. So I don't know why you need to watch 50 Shades of Grey to see just, like, the top half of Jamie Dornan's dick for a half second. You do. You're giving me that face. You definitely see the top part of his dick. He's unzipping his pants, and you definitely see, like, just the
There's
top.
Dickage? Oh, my God. I did not see that.
Just the shaft.
Oh, man. This is, like, Gone Girl. Like, did we see Ben's dick at some point? But well, and that's another thing that is kind of interesting about these movies. Whether there's an abusive component or it's just sex, the women are always naked or we're always seeing their breasts or their vaginas or their asses. We don't see anything from the guys. Like, there's no butts, there's no dicks, there's no if, ends, or dicks about it.
My favorite is when they do try to reverse that and they do the L-shaped bed sheets, the PG-13 bed sheets, where for some reason a couple wakes up together and the woman has the bed sheet up to her armpits and the man has
the guy
it down
doesn't. I forgot about
waist.
That.
Those are so weird. Okay, but when I got to the end of 50 Shades of Grey, and it ends with Anna leaving Christian. Like, she says, nope, this is clearly too dark for me, I'm out.
Mm-hmm.
I watched it and I said, son of a bitch. Because I realized that I thought for a second that, well, if she leaves him at the end, this isn't great for the podcast. Like, she wises up. So I had to go look up what happens next so I wasn't going to subject myself to it.
But you didn't know about that there was, like, a three series?
Oh, I knew it was a trilogy.
Okay.
So I figured, like, she had to come back at some point. They had to get together. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it's, like, 3 days later. Like, the next book starts, like, 3 days after that happens.
Oh, girlfriend doesn't even give herself time
no.
to get over this.
No,
oh,
and she's, like, she's starting a new job at a publishing company at the end of that movie. At the beginning of the next book, He buys the publishing company.
So he can get her?
So he can be closer to her and have control over her. And now we're in a boss-employer relationship,
mm-hmm.
which is also very strange. And that, like, leads to a degree of who can and who cannot consent.
Mm-hmm.
Once there's a power dynamic like that, where, like, literally your jobs are on the line, your livelihood, that becomes... It becomes harder to consent and say affirmatively yes.
Right.
You know.
Well, and also it goes back to the idea of financial abuse. When somebody, because the women who leave abusive relationships to get help for themselves and their children, the question, unfortunately, they get asked often, which is unfair, is, well, if you knew that this person was hurting you, why did you stay in it for so long? Like, what was it that kept you in there, and why wouldn't you protect yourself or your children? And in some cases, women can't leave. Especially if they have a partner who has access to their bank accounts, who takes their paycheck away from them as soon as they get it, who has them on an allowance, who keeps them from having a job outside the home so that they always have to be in the house. They don't have jobs that they can point to, so that means they can't build their resume and they don't have anything to point to when they go to job interviews. It's just a vicious cycle.
It comes down to, like, one of the first signs is cutting off all access to the outside world.
And that's the thing, is with abusers, well, we were talking about this earlier before we got here, abuse is a gradual process. It's not just the two people go out to dinner and as soon as they sit down at the table, unless you're the Notebook, as we know,
yeah.
unless you're the Notebook, usually an abusive partner doesn't slap you or physically assault you as soon as you get started. It's a gradual process that begins with verbal things like, I don't like the way your hair looks. I don't like your job. You should quit it. I don't like your friends. And then it escalates to shoving, or I need your passwords for all of your online accounts and your phone so that I can check up on you. And then the end result is the physical abuse that we see portrayed in movies so much.
Now, in 50 Shades, there's a scene where they, like, negotiate a contract.
Oh, God, the contract negotiation scene.
To be fair,
that was the best shot scene in the movie, yeah, actually.
And to be fair to Dakota Johnson, it's the best acted scene in the movie.
Yes.
She sells that movie or that scene as hard as she can. I feel like she deserves better. But they develop a contract for their relationship, which should be a red flag right there. But this contract extends beyond the bedroom. It's not just like, these are my limits. These are what I will do. These are what I won't do. Butt plugs is that fun little line that Dakota Johnson has where she asks it, like, questioningly, which is hilarious. But their contract, their agreement goes to further things, like what she eats.
Yep.
And
how much she should weigh, where she lives during this relationship.
And that's so not okay. It's also, like, very strange to say that because you consent to something once, you agree to something once,
yes,
you agree to
it. Yes, the blanket consent idea.
Every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no contract can change that.
Well, and it's like what Jess was saying, that consent is an active process. It's an idea, the idea that there's only, that you consent once and that suddenly covers all future acts is a problem. You have these states that have laws on the books that say that rape that happens within a marriage can't be prosecuted because by marrying somebody, you're now consenting to all future sexual acts with them.
It wasn't until 1993 that was made illegal.
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous. So let's move into this. Why aren't we talking about this? Why, when these things pop up, because they do pop up in media for centuries, do we not discuss it? And I think part of it is because we just don't discuss what abuse actually looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to get some more insight on some of the topics that we're talking about today, I turned to some friends of mine who educate teenagers and actually do trainings for different employers in the city of Philadelphia when it comes to domestic violence. The quote that we're going to hear right now is from my friend Sharon Rice, who is basically talking about why we have issues with defining exactly what abuse is.
So you have reality television shows like The Bad Girls Club that sort of depict a type of person, right? And that person reacts violently, aggressively, and everyone gets to watch that, and it's that's sort of who that person is. And then you have shows that depict, well, if you can sort of tame yourself, this is what a tamer version of an unhealthy slash potentially abusive relationship could look like. And I think I'm not really sure if that, you know, that the line between those two things is very clear. But if for me, I see sort of the transition from this is who you are as sort of an outrageous adult. And then when you're stopped being outrageous, you get more sophisticated in your outrage and you can kind of hide it at home. And so I think it just sort of perpetuates this idea that as long as you're consenting at some point, maybe it's okay, but then there's never really a point that says none of this is okay. Yeah, at some level when someone wrongs you, it's not okay, but at what point does that wronging become abusive? And I think it's just teaching and understanding what does it mean to be abusive. I don't know that our culture really talks about abuse as a thing that exists. It's often peripheral to the rest of the situation, you know. Just dialing back to 50 Shades of Grey, it's like it. Someone could look at that relationship in that movie and that book and say it's abusive, but the wealth, the sort of romanticized way in which the relationship is depicted kind of diminishes the fact that they might be abusive. And so we really kind of in some ways are judging books by their cover.
Ho, 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 ho! Merry Christmas!
Greetings, holiday shoppers. I'm Joseph Wade, and I host a podcast called Christmas Creeps. My band of merry mischief makers and I dissect holiday movies and specials all year round in search of the true meaning of Christmas. So whether you can't resist the urge to watch Home Alone in June, or you worship at the altar of mutant killer snowmen, Christmas Creeps is the podcast for the Grinch in all of us. Check us out at ChristmasCreeps.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Established that societally we don't always talk about what abuse is.
Right.
And we've also established that we get our social cues, kind of learn our norms from media that is also part of the society. So the problem is when you combine those two together, it's incredibly easy to establish social cues that we don't realize may be abusive because we don't talk about what abuse looks like.
Absolutely.
So it was just mentioned that oftentimes, this abuse is pushed off to the side. It's set off to the periphery. So let's talk about The Notebook, where it's wildly on display.
Yeah, it's inherent from the beginning that these two are abusing each other.
But it is, like, glossed up and given romantic music and carnival lights and played as romantic.
Yeah. Like, well, and I also think that part of it's excused because they're like, oh, but it's equal. She's hitting him as much as he's hitting her. And I think what's important to note is, when you were a little kid, did you ever see shows like Dynasty, Falcon Crest, like the Aaron Spelling?
Your soap operas.
Exactly, yeah. The nighttime soap operas. How many times did a female character slap either another female character or a guy, like, how could you, or something like that? Or you think about Moonstruck, where it's an affectionate, you know, snap out of it type thing.
Which is the best scene in the movie.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, I mean, it needed to happen. But when you think about, there are some scenes where Rachel McAdams is slapping him.
Just frequently.
Yeah.
And it's cute, right?
Yeah, it's shown as a cute, feminine action. Whereas if somebody punches you, that's seen as aggressive. Like, this has no, there's love has nothing to do with this action that I'm about to do to you. It's an aggressive thing to either protect myself or to keep you under my thumb. And I just think it's so interesting that both of those physical acts of assault are, both of those acts of assault are on full display, but we excuse them because we see that they're in the service of the relationship.
I think part of it is that there's this physical threat, basically. It's a matter of a threat level. Like, the idea that basically Ryan Gosling, if he wanted to, if he hit back, he could definitely do some damage to Rachel McAdams.
Oh, but I see. And showing restraint just shows what a good man he is.
Right, right. Because she's not really a threat to him. She could, that weak female could never possibly hurt the big, strong man.
Right.
And she could never, and that demeans a whole lot of things.
Well, and it also doesn't speak to, there is a large problem with men being victims of domestic violence at the hands of female partners. It does happen.
Yeah, and so it belittles that idea. It
shows that some forms of abuse are more valid, or the survivor is more likely to be believed than others, which is really harmful.
So, yeah, and it's just one of those strange things that this movie loves to do. This is, like, from Nicholas Sparks. Nicholas Sparks sparked... I did not mean to do that, but we'll say
no pun intended.
Nicholas sparked... Pun is intended now. Nicholas sparked a whole, like, series of, like, romantic subgenre, which, again, like, this existed before him.
Yeah.
But he became kind of the apex of it.
Yeah, and we have to be fair, because I was talking with a friend the other day, with romance novels, every author, or at least the successful ones, they find a formula and then they recycle it over and over again. So he's not doing anything wrong. The problem that I have with a lot of his novels is that he's portraying unhealthy and or abusive traits as romantic and necessary. And I think that's
fun,
the problem.
And exciting.
Yeah, like if you feel alive and you sense danger and, like, you're feeling all these heightened emotions, and that is what love is, and that's not what love is.
Yeah, it's very strange. And it also, like, Richard Curtis movies do this a lot.
Oh,
right?
Like Love Actually, Notting Hill.
And again,
Four Weddings and a Funeral.
I love it when I see it on the screen. You know,
but you sure as hell wouldn't want it happening in real life.
Right. I imagine that, like, being Richard Curtis's girlfriend gets very, very tiring after a little bit. Like, you come down the stairs, and he's just got this full orchestra, and he's brought in, like, a giraffe or something. And he's like, we did this for you. We did this all for you. And you're like, God damn it, Richard, I just wanted a bowl of cereal. Like, no. But
is that really how it went down?
Maybe. The one night I spent with Richard Curtis was a very magical occasion.
Okay.
Oh, it's ridiculous. And it does teach this idea that, like, in order to get somebody interested in you, in order to get someone to like you, by the way, getting someone to like you is...
Let that sink in for a moment.
Yeah. You can't get someone to like you. They like you or they don't like you.
And you shouldn't try to convince them if they don't like you, because A, that's coercion and that's an abusive trait, but also that means somebody really awesome who will like you for who you are is out there.
So we'll talk about this a little bit more in the second segment when we talk about masculinity. And the effects this has on men. But it does teach this idea that you have to make this big grand gesture.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a big thing. You have to, sing the Righteous Brothers to Kelly McGinnis in Top Gun, you know, which is more embarrassing than it is romantic in real life, to be honest.
Right. And then
holding
a radio up for your girlfriend if it say anything.
Which is, you know, another example of that's stalking,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's another example of the not getting the hint trope,
exactly.
Which is also very prevalent in The Notebook.
Yeah. Spoiler alert, guys. Do not be persistent. If a girl tells you she's not interested, back away. Not today.
Or even if she doesn't tell you flat out. If she just stops responding to your texts, like...
It's time to move on.
You'll justify it for a little bit. You'll be like, oh, maybe she's busy. Or she'll get to me later. I saw the red notification. She definitely saw it, you know. And you'll start saying, well, maybe there's just something else going. And then you do the weird obsessive thing where you're, like, checking their Instagram and checking their Facebook and whatnot. And
you got time for this, but you don't have time to write my text back.
And this is how it starts, right? Because I've done this.
You've done this. Everybody's done this.
We've all done this, and we all realize how unhealthy it is, and most of us move on from it.
You're right.
But
if you're Ryan Gosling in The Notebook, you write 365 letters and wonder why you're not getting anything.
Write every day for a year. And they justify it.
Yeah, they exaggerate the things that would be creepy behavior in real life and turn it into romance and desire in a movie.
Yeah, in the movie, it's, like, shown that he was right the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the parents were blocking the letters from getting to her. So that, like, ridiculous idea that you have in your head for why she didn't get your text.
They make it real in the notebook.
They make it true in The Notebook.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and give a couple of notes about The Notebook itself, just as a film.
Yeah.
I do like Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams together. I really like their chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Although
I will say, Bro has freakishly strong leg muscles because he carries her all the way from the dock into the bedroom. And I'm just like, that is amazing. Give that guy a trophy.
At that point, you're just going to roll over and be like, you're going to be on top.
Oh, man.
Also, I do think that Ryan Gosling is wasted when he plays these romantic lead.
And we don't mean that he's high on drugs. We mean that he's not being used to his full potential.
He might be high on drugs.
Maybe it's the only way you can get through it.
I would smoke weed with Ryan Gosling. But no, I do think he's best when he's playing like a sardonic, like smart asshole, mm-hmm. like in The Nice Guys, or when he's playing that to like blank psychopath. Like in Drive.
Right.
But I think because he's a very good looking guy who is naturally a little charming, they put him in these romantic lead roles where he doesn't like have the full potential. Like, I think he's the weakest part of La La Land.
Yeah.
And I like La La Land a lot.
Well, what's interesting is Rachel McAdams is kind of like his equivalent in that respect, because after Mean Girls, she was cast in several films where she plays a self-absorbed, beautiful girl who doesn't understand that true beauty comes from within, and then we kind of go on that journey with her, and then by the end she realizes, I can be a nice person and be beautiful, and the world will be at my feet and everybody's happy. So she's underutilized. It's strictly about who's the hottest girl right now that can play this off. So I think that it was kind of cool that they were put together in this movie, because they complement each other in that way.
Yeah, I also like James Marsden in this.
Oh, poor James. Always a bridesmaid, never a bride.
By the way, you forgot that James Marsden was in this movie, didn't you?
I did. I totally did.
Yeah, no, poor James Marsden. He always has the girl stolen from him. And their relationship in this movie, like, he's fine.
Yeah.
Like, they have a perfectly...
He doesn't beat her up and doesn't take it from her either.
Yeah, which is weird. Because then we get to this, like, idea that the abuser can't... Or the abusee can't be with, like... a normal, healthy relationship.
Yeah.
They always want to go back to the person that treats them. Like, the only, like, real flaw that James Marsden has in this movie is that he's a little boring,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of the role you always put James Marsden in.
Yeah.
Cyclops.
That's a good point.
Like, he when he gets his girl stolen from, by Hugh Jackman, and, yeah. you know, understandable, right? Your choices are James Marsden or Hugh Jackman.
You're gonna go for Hugh Jackman.
He loses out to Superman in Superman Returns.
Yeah. It's not fair. He always has a good job and he's got his stuff together. And then this other guy
just fine.
That's kind of all over the place gets the girl. It's like, come on.
In Enchanted, he winds up with Idina Menzel, but he doesn't wind up with Amy Adams, who he thought he was going to be with, because Amy Adams gets with Patrick Dempsey, who is also always losing out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patrick Dempsey always is. This is our James Marsden, Patrick Dempsey support group hour.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the other thing we got to get into, and this is, I think we're going to date ourselves at this point, because I don't even know if The Notebook is relevant anymore, and I don't know if people still read Twilight.
Mm-hmm.
But we should talk about some of the behaviors that happen in Twilight.
Yes.
Specifically, if you want to define this, specifically, Edward's gaslighting.
Yeah. So gaslighting is interesting because for many years there wasn't a name for it until there was a movie in the 1940s, I want to say.
1946, I think.
Yeah, called Gaslight with Ingrid Bergman. She plays a woman whose husband is trying to steal her fortune, and in order to get it, he tries to make her go crazy and point out to her and everybody around her that my wife does these weird things. She's mentally ill. She needs to be locked up so that he can get to the fortune. So he'll move her things around and then say, don't you remember? You left this thing over here and now it's in my coat pocket. No, you didn't hear noises. I didn't hear anything. You're crazy. So basically it's saying things to undermine somebody else to convince them that they're the one that's in the wrong. No, that text wasn't from a girl that I'm seeing on the side. No, I wasn't out all last night with somebody who wasn't you. You're just thinking that because you're clingy and you're insecure. So they play on your insecurities to make you think that you're the person in the wrong, when in fact they're the one that's in the wrong by deceiving you and making you feel insecure.
It's also played for horror in like Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
And that's where most of the scary part of that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very interesting to see it played for romance in something like Twilight.
Yeah.
So if you're not sure what we're actually talking about, there's a scene in the first Twilight movie where Bella Swan, after she's moved to Force Washington. She's met this brooding, angry, pretty boy named Edward Cullen, who everybody's, like, interested in, but nobody can get close to. He's a jerk to her from the very, like, moment he sees her. He's like, go. He treats her like dirt. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, if they do that at the beginning, they're always going to do that.
People don't change. Yeah. They are who they are.
Yeah. But he does, quote-unquote, change when he saves her from a runaway car.
Yeah, he becomes more of a stalker.
Right. But specifically, he saves her from a car using his, like, super vampire powers. Mm-hmm. And when she calls him out on it later, he says, like, no, I didn't do that. That's not what happened. And at that point, like, it's almost like the Superman Lois Lane thing. But then he flat out says, no one's ever going to believe you. And it takes it to a whole nother
creepy,
level.
Creepy, creepy, creepy level.
And it's justified because he's trying to, like, keep the family secret. Right?
Yeah. Again, in which case, if somebody's keeping secrets from you, that's a huge boundary issue right there.
Yeah, and it's like, I just mentioned Superman and a secret identity, and is it that different? Maybe, maybe not. But the difference is that when Bella falls in line with the Cullens, she gives up everything else in order to keep that important secret of their vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she gives up her family, she cuts off contact with her friends, and everything in her life goes towards being with Edward, essentially.
And that's another behavior that you find in a great many domestic violence situations, is the dominant partner will say, I don't like your friends, or I don't think your family's a good influence on you. You should be spending more time with me, which is also a factor that keeps partners from leaving their abusive relationships, because their friends are angry at them. Their family's like, well, you kind of left us, which means you don't want us anymore. So they're literally alone. They have no support systems in place that they can turn to in order to get help and get away from this person who's controlling them.
It's also the behavior of a cult.
Yeah.
And the Cullens in those books are very much a cult.
Yeah.
They're a weird cult family. By the way, I just want to say, in the first Twilight movie, like, everybody in that high school is really comfortable with just saying, oh, that's the family of siblings that fuck each other.
Incest. It's the new thing.
Like, they're just like, you know, it's like, oh, there's the nerds, there's the jocks, there's the JV team, and there's the incest family. Like,
yeah, there's the cousin humpers.
And they're just really comfortable with it. It's very strange.
Which, I know that we said at the top of the episode we weren't here to kink shame. Incest is never a good
idea. I'm going to kink shame that.
That is kink shameable. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so getting back to some of the behavior in Twilight. So Edward cuts her off entirely, and then he leaves, quote unquote, for her own protection.
Yeah.
And she goes insane after that because she doesn't have anything left.
Mm-hmm. Because she's cut herself off from her family and this is her whole world, and now suddenly her whole world leaves.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as Ryan Gosling hanging off the Ferris wheel. Like, I'm going to
keep going to that example.
Yeah, I'm going to isolate myself. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to hurt myself. That's a threat. I mean, a woman might not leave a relationship if her husband is saying, well, if you leave me, I will kill myself, because you're threatening to hurt somebody that she loves very much, and she doesn't want that. Even though she knows that what this person is doing to her is wrong, she'll still stay with him.
Let's also keep in mind that, like, through their entire relationship, Edward is a threat to Bella.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he
literally wants to eat her.
He very clearly says, I'm going to hurt you. I'm restraining myself because I'm not...
And that's not sexy. Someone's like, I could hurt you if I wanted to. It's like, my ass is gone. I'm out.
Yeah, that's what you say when you got to get into a fight with a guy at a bar. Right?
Yeah.
That's the, like, let's take this outside line.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Bella, Anna, anyone that's in these novels, run the other way. Do not think that this is cute. It is unacceptable. Get out.
Yeah. I will point out that one of the threads that links Bella and Anna together, and a lot of other characters, these women aren't written as characters in their own right.
Yeah, they don't have much agency. They just exist for the whims of their love interest.
Like, we're told that Bella is smart, but we're never really shown it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both of these women, they are clumsy.
Oh, God, Anna falls into Christian's office right as she meets him.
Because, like, that's a writing hack trope to just use clumsiness instead of a personality. Like, they treat that as a flaw, which means, like, look,
aren't
I've got
cute?
A flawed character.
Yeah.
Part of that is, I'm going to show my, like, knowledge of the internet now. All of these stem from Harry Potter fanfic. No, it's the truth. Twilight came from a Harry Potter fanfic and was adapted, and Fifty Shades was adapted from a Twilight fanfic, so it's all the same root. So Anna Steele and Bella Swan, they're all versions of Ginny Weasley.
Oh, my mind has been blown.
No, it's because Ginny Weasley, for the first little bit of the Harry Potter books, complete nothing character.
Well, I mean, she served a purpose in Chamber of Secrets. She was the person who was kidnapped. Again, damsel in distress that has no personality besides I need to be rescued.
With a little literal serpent. Like, you had to fight the giant monster with a sword.
Yes.
Like, she was the MacGuffin, right? Mm. You had to go and get it. But, like, that's not a personality.
Right.
But she's still a character. So, young women, primarily women, who were writing these fanfics, put themselves in the Ginny Weasley role.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because she's nothing, you can project yourself in there.
Or and she's then, undefined.
Right. Right. And so you can put yourself in there and make that your self-insert without it being a self-insert.
And then that would mean that Christian Grey and Edward Cullen are the bad boy, which would be
Draco Malfoy.
Dang. Yeah.
That's how that happens.
Yeah.
So this is not like, we're not going to let Harry Potter off the hook for this as well. And the real issue I have the real disturbing thing is that lots of young women read this book.
Oh, yeah. Mostly they bought tickets to see the movies.
Yeah. And so you had an entire generation, basically, of young girls who looked at that and said, yeah, this is the relationship that I want. This is what true love looks like.
Yeah.
And most of them have probably grown out of it by now.
Mm-hmm.
Or
graduated to 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, hopefully not, but that's probably literally what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's funny to think of Twilight as the gateway drug.
It is. It is. So this is one of those things that they're getting those social cues from that we talked about earlier. They're getting those cues from something like Twilight.
Yeah.
And that's not a healthy thing. So you've got a generation that does this. We're going to take a break right now, but in our next segment, we're going to talk about how unhealthy portrayals of relationships are not just a issue that affects women. They also affect boys, especially young boys, too. So we're going to talk about masculinity when we come up on Political Theater right after this. You hit me once, I hit you back. You gave a kick, I gave a slap. You smashed a plate over my head. Then I set fire to our bed. Oh, my black eye casts no shadow. Your red eye sees no blame. Your slaps don't stick, your kicks don't hit. So we remain the same. Elastics, sweat drips. Break the lock if it don't fit. Kicking the teeth is good for some. A kiss with a fist is better.
This is the secret of
the sailor
band.
Yes.
Oh, Sam, I'm so tired. We'll stop and rest. And saying, it's okay, Mr. Frodo. We'll rest. Everything will be okay tomorrow. And they're like, tomorrow. Everything will be fine tomorrow.
Yeah, and then it's like, oh, I think we might have to give up. This is too difficult a quest. It's so easy not to try. That's a song. Everything. I actually really like that song, but it's just like, my God, why is there a song for everything the characters are going through?
Secret of the Sailor Madness, the cynicism-free animation appreciation podcast.
Without being overly earnest about things.
But not too serious either.
Discover it for yourself at secretofthesailormadness.com or on your favorite podcast aggregator.
Secret of the Sailor Madness, overthinking cartoons for fun and profit.
What is toxic masculinity?
So, this sort of sense that, like, how one believes that a man should act like or sort of express whatever emotions or sexuality in such a way that it's, like, toxic and damaging to the, you know, to society or to relationships to other people. I guess I think that sort of violence is kind of, like, is pervasive just in kind of the different forms it can be from sexually, emotionally, and physically, I mean, and then economically. So in a sense of like how we interact with people is like violence is normal. And that, like, of course that bleeds into our relationships and how we see and sort of connect to each other. So yeah, I guess it doesn't surprise me that those messages kind of sort of filter through.
So that was my friend Christian Hayden. Christian is a community educator who talks about teen dating violence and healthy relationships with kids across the school district of Philadelphia. And Christian was talking about a concept that we're going to delve into a little bit more deeply in this segment called toxic masculinity.
Toxic masculinity is essentially just this idea that there is one way to be a man. There's one way to be a man in a relationship. And if you don't fit this mold, if you're not expressing your masculinity in a certain way, that it's wrong. And the reason we say this is toxic is because the manner in which this idea encourages you to be a man is often very harmful, both to yourself and to other people.
There was an article in The Atlantic recently that talked about mass shootings that have been happening in the United States over the past year. And for our purposes, that's like 2016 into 2017. And the common thread in all of these shootings is that there was a man behind the trigger. And in the instance of the Orlando shooting, you had a man that was so out of touch with his feelings and so threatened by what it meant to be a man who was gay, who hated gays. How he would prove, well, I'm a man, even though I have these feelings that I need to repress and that I don't feel comfortable embracing, I have to prove that I'm a man by picking up a gun and killing these threats to my masculinity. So toxic masculinity has very far-reaching effects. It's not just something that is a personal dilemma for a man. It's something that can have drastic consequences for society at large.
Well, let's go back and talk about strictly how this factors into relationships and dating and the movies. So we've talked about where women get a lot of their social cues. Young women have gotten social cues from. David Wong from Cracked wrote an article that I like called seven ways that men are taught to believe that sexual assault is no big deal. And the clip that he uses to explain this, something that every single guy has seen, is this clip right here from The Empire Strikes Back. This is the first time that Han Solo kisses Leia.
Hey, your worship, I'm only trying to help.
Would you please stop calling me that?
Sure, Leia.
You make it so difficult sometimes.
I do, I really do. You could be a little nicer, though. Come on, admit it. Sometimes you think I'm all right.
Occasionally, maybe. When you aren't acting like a scoundrel.
Scoundrel? Scoundrel? I like the sound of that.
Stop that.
Stop what?
Stop that. My hands are dirty.
My hands are dirty, too. What are you afraid of?
Afraid?
You're trembling.
I'm not trembling.
Because I'm a scoundrel. There aren't enough scoundrels in your life.
I happen to like nice men.
Nice men.
Very nice.
So I'm going to steal directly from David Wong there. This is, when this scene is happening, Leia cannot escape. She's forced up against a wall for this kiss. And even if she could get out, she's still stuck on the ship with Han. Like, he's around her all the time. And it's really just because he forces himself on her and they kiss and she starts to like it that we accept it as being okay. And yeah. This is something that you're taught, basically, as a man. Like, oh, if you can get her to like it, stepping up to the plate and grabbing her and just pulling her towards you, that's a masculine ideal. And that's a super unhealthy thing that literally every young man sees and almost idolizes.
Taking what's mine. Well, and there's also, when 50 Shades of Grey came out, the idea of grey sex really started to gain prevalence in references and in pop culture. And grey sex is the idea that a sexual encounter starts out as rape, but it becomes okay because while the woman resists initially, she starts to come on board and really realizes, you know, quote unquote, realizes that she likes what's being done to her and starts to go with it.
And this is a thing for most men. Like, you're encouraged, hey, just go with it. Just go for it. Grab her. She'll go for it. Like, the idea is almost that if you ask first, or if you kind of feel it out, if you're not grabbing her, you're not a man. There's a bit in the TV show New Girl, which aired in 2012, where a female character is talking to a male character, Cece, and her then-boyfriend, Schmidt, where she makes fun of him for the idea that he would ever ask a woman that it's okay to kiss her. Mm-hmm. Like, she flat-out says, this was written by men, by the way, like, there's nothing less sexy than being asked to kiss someone. And you can take that a couple of ways. The way that you could take that generously is saying, you know, you should be in tone with the person that you're with. You should pick up on their signals enough that you'll know when they want to kiss you.
Right.
That's not the way most people do it.
Right.
Because most people, most men especially, aren't that good on picking up on those signals.
I'm not even good on picking up on those signals.
Right. Yeah, there's always that weird, like, awkward, like, should I do this now? Do I do the kiss? You know, that's hard. It's hard, and the idea that just flat out asking would make it worse is not a healthy idea whatsoever.
Right.
So, and you mentioned earlier taking what's yours. So that's another thing that plays out in these dynamics, right? That we're taught that it's romantic for the man to be a predator. We're taught that the woman has to run away. The metaphor they use in Twilight is the lion laying down with the lamb, right? So it's this idea that in order to be a man in a relationship, you have to chase after what you're going for. You have to go for it. In fact, there's that clip from, we're going to go back to The Notebook, where right after the Ferris wheel scene, the next time that Ryan Gosling sees her, he insists that he just has to have her. When I see something, I just gotta have it.
Look, I know as you get some dirty guy coming up to you on the street, you don't know him. You don't know me, but I know me. And when I see something that I like, I got it. I love it. I go crazy for it.
What are you talking about?
Well, you.
Oh, you're good.
What?
You're good.
No.
You're good.
No, you're getting me wrong.
You're fantastic. You really are. I'm impressed.
I'm not usually like this. I'm
yes,
sorry.
You are.
That could be fun.
If you want. Pensive.
Smart. Superstitious. Brave. And I could be light on my feet. I could be whatever you want. You just tell me what you want, and I'll be that for you.
You're dumb.
I could be that.
Another important thing to mention is, you know, if we're seeing that it's a problem to simply ask somebody, is it okay if I kiss you? That means that someone's going to feel uncomfortable later on down the line when they're about to engage in sex to say, hey, I like where this is going. Can we please discuss safe sex? Like, can we please discuss that one of us has to put a condom on to protect each other from anything that we might not be aware of?
It doesn't even need to be that direct. Just a simple, hey, do you have a condom?
Like, exactly. And what's interesting in these movies is, and again, we have to keep in mind that teenagers and people who haven't gone out on many dates or are about to start going out on dates, they're not only watching this as, oh, isn't this romantic or isn't this fun entertainment? They're watching
sexy.
This. Yeah. They're watching this as an instruction manual. So if nobody is putting on a condom, if nobody's having conversations of, hey, I hope you protect, you practice safe sex the way I do, that means that people who are about to be sexually active are not going to realize that at some point that piece has to be in the conversation.
Except for the one moment in 50 Shades
yep.
where they do show Christian Grey grabbing a condom and opening it with his teeth.
I mean, spoiler alert, do not open condoms with your teeth.
Never
that is asking.
Do that.
And I mean, when I was a Peace Corps volunteer, there are several steps to putting on a condom. I mean, you check the expiration, you kind of, you press the packaging to make sure there's no holes and to make sure that there's some air in there, which means that it's fresh. Opening the condom, you know, not with your teeth, making sure it's on properly, and then you're ready to rock end or roll.
The other thing is, we mentioned earlier this idea of making the grand gesture.
Yes.
That if it's not asked for, if you don't already know that the object of your affection wants this, what you're doing is just embarrassing. If you are Heath Ledger singing "You're Just Too Good to Be True" in 10 Things I Hate About You, again, super romantic moment. I love it in that scene in 10 Things I Hate About You. But it's entirely possible for that to just backfire, especially if the girl is not into you.
And from what I remember, you've had experience with keeping it real or keeping it romantic going horribly wrong.
Yeah! All right.
Lay it on us.
We're going to tell a story from Marty's dating life. So this happened probably about 6 years ago. And this was my last year of college, and I had just gotten out of my first major relationship. So I was, like, still learning how to meet people and how to date again and, like, how to do that. And I was sitting at my favorite bar, eating a sandwich, and this really pretty girl sits next to me, like, prom queen pretty. And I'm not talking to her. I'm watching TV. I'm watching Starship Troopers on TV, as a matter of fact. And she looks up at the screen and she says, "Oh, hey, Starship Troopers is on." This was before I had my little awakening, like, girls can be nerds too? What?
What?
Right? So that's my opening. We start to talk about Starship Troopers. We start to talk about our nerdy interests. We flirt a little bit. And at one point in time, she, like, laughs at me playfully for being a little bit too nerdy. And she says, "I bet you own a cape, don't you?" Playing it cool, I respond, "I assure you, I do not have a cape." And she, again, rolling with the punches, says, "Well, that's too bad. You could have gotten laid tonight. I have a thing for capes." Really funny, flirty moment. So here's where I take it too far. So I get this girl's number, and I also happen to work at a toy department of a major department store at the time.
A recipe for disaster.
And we sold capes. And I thought it would be funny if, like, I picked her up on this date, or we went on a date, and I showed up wearing the cape. No, I'm sorry. I thought it would be funny if I went to a restaurant, left to go to the bathroom, and came back wearing the cape.
Oh, God, you didn't.
Kind of like a, hey, I'm ready to rock thing. So I had this planned out, like, for a week in advance. I went and got the cape. I went to a restaurant where my friend was a cook, and my plan was to give him the cape so that he could have it back, and when I left, I could go and get it from him. I hadn't done that yet. So the cape is still in my pocket. And I go next door to the bar where I met this girl originally, and as I'm walking in, she's walking out. And she says, "Oh, hey, I'm gonna see you later, blah, blah, blah." And I say, and I don't know why I did this to this day, but I say, "Oh, cool. Well, hey, I wanted to show you something." And I can feel myself in slow motion going, "Why are you doing this? Stop." But I pull the cape out of my pocket.
It's out there.
It's out there. I just whipped it out.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
And I tie the cape around my neck. And I'm like, "Eh?" And she goes, "Oh."
What?
And she walks away.
Moment gone.
Like, the super embarrassing moment. We're just standing there talking to a man in the middle of a bar wearing a child's cape. And, yeah, so I definitely got the "let's just be friends" text later that night.
And you learned a valuable lesson that grand gestures are best left to the movies.
They really are. Or just like when you at least understand your partner or understand a little bit of it.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that you see in movies. Like, romantic gestures are super extreme.
Mm-hmm.
They're always like, especially in the case of Fifty Shades of Grey, like, I bought you this laptop, since you've apparently never owned one.
Or I sold your car that you loved very much to get you a bigger, faster one.
Right.
Without telling you.
Made that decision without telling you.
Yeah, which is, again, controlling and abusive.
And it's just like, okay, there's nothing wrong with wanting to do something nice for somebody, but context, right? You just met somebody, you need to do, like, put it in stages. You can't be buying them giant expensive gifts right off.
Yeah, and I appreciate you brought up a word that I think is really important when it comes to talking about what is abuse and what isn't abuse, which is context.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a training for domestic violence recently, and we learned, particularly in our lessons about stalking, that, I mean, there are certain behaviors that could be interpreted as, depending on the person, romantic, and then behaviors that could be construed as, this is clearly stalking. And the one example they gave us is, your ex sends you a Christmas card. Nothing else, just you're getting a Christmas card in the mail from your ex. We started to fill in the blanks of, well, did you split up on amicable terms? Was the ex controlling? Did you give your address to your ex? Is it the holidays? Is it your birthday? Because for the example that we arrived on, if you moved out of state to get away from an abusive ex, you're in your new home, you're starting to feel safer, things are getting back to normal, and then suddenly you get a Christmas card or a birthday card from your ex, and you didn't give out that address, that's stalking, and it's also the context of, I didn't invite you to write to me at this address, and now you're writing to me, so there's definitely a message being delivered here, and it's not, I hope you had a really happy birthday or season's greetings, it's, I know where you are, and I'm coming to find you. And that is scary as shit in real life.
So a lot of these things that we're making fun of, these, like, large-scale gestures, they could be perceived as romantic in real life. They could be done well if the context was right.
Like sending several text messages or sending a letter every day for a year.
Had I just shown up to, like, pick her up on the date wearing the cape, we had a good laugh, and then I took it off, that would have worked.
Absolutely.
That would have been.
It's good that you know that now.
Right.
You'll never do it again.
Never, ever again. But back to Star Wars, right?
Yes.
Who doesn't want to be Han Solo? Everyone wants to be Han Solo.
And who doesn't want to be with Han Solo?
Right. So he's incredibly, like, he's a sexy man. And
just doesn't know how to fly planes in real life very well.
No. Or listen to air traffic controllers.
Yeah, sorry, Harrison.
I'm not sorry, Harrison.
Call me.
So here's your hero, right? Grabbing the woman that he wants to be
with. Taking what's his.
Taking what's his. You know, and she swoons. And we go, yeah, that's right. And honestly, this message continues. The movie Ratatouille, like, has a scene where Linguini, voiced by, what's it, Ray Romano's brother, has...
Brad somebody.
No, his actual brother.
Oh.
Yeah. But he's got the little mouse on top of his head. And he's about to confess to the female chef that this is happening, right? That what's going on. I said, I've got a little rat. So to control him, the mouse, Remy, grabs him by the hair and throws him onto her,
Ooh. Basically.
So he forces her into a kiss. And she's seen pulling, like, mace out of her purse. She has pepper spray in her hand. And she's going to, like, press down on it. Until she's like, oh, I kind of like this. And then they start kissing.
Yeah.
Right? So it's this idea that you don't ask permission, you ask forgiveness.
Yeah.
And also, like, it's not rape if she actually really wanted it.
Or if it becomes that she really wanted it.
Right. James Bond?
Mm-hmm.
James Bond rapes several women. most explicitly... what he does with Pussy Galore in, I think, Octopussy, where he basically, like, forces himself on her in a barn. And this is, like, the message you're sending. Like, this is, as a man, this is what you're supposed to do. Women are always going to play hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get anywhere, because they're going to try to keep it from you, you got to, like, push them into it.
And, I mean, that has long-term, far-reaching repercussions. I mean, you see... Like, there's the Bi Felicia account on Instagram, which is nothing but screenshots of men who have, through messages, violently reacted to women who said, "You seem really nice, but I'm just not interested." The toxic masculinity is what causes people to lash out and say that they're going to hurt you, threaten you, and it's a reason why there's a high number of transgender women who are being murdered, because when they reveal them their true selves to their partners, and the partner's like, "Whoa, I'm not gay, but I've kissed you, maybe we've done sexual things, and I didn't realize this part of you, and now you're forcing me to come to terms with it, and I can't deal with it." There are many consequences to that concept that we haven't even scratched the surface of in this country.
There's also, like, an element of weakness to this. Like, this idea that boys will be boys. They'll just do what they're going to do because they can't help it. Mm-hmm. Because they're weak. And I want to do a super recent example, which is honestly kind of the inspiration for this episode, and then we just never talked about it. But that was 2015's Passengers. So I'm gonna give some spoiler alerts here for Passengers, because
if you haven't seen it, press the pause button.
No, screw that. It's a terrible movie. Don't see it.
Just don't see it anyway.
But what happens in Passengers is Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence play characters who are on a spaceship.
They're passengers.
Yeah. And this spaceship has them en route to New Earth. They're going to go there and live. So they're laying there in cryogenic chambers, and Chris Pratt accidentally wakes up. His chamber malfunctions, and he's there for a year. He wakes up, and he looks around the ship, and he's alone on this ship for an entire year. And he finds this pod that has Jennifer Lawrence in it, and he becomes obsessed with Jennifer Lawrence. He becomes obsessed with this woman, whose name is Aurora, by the way, which is a reference to Sleeping Beauty.
Right.
And he starts reading everything about her in her, like, crew files and things like this. This woman in this chamber. And then, after a year of going insane by himself, he's so weak and so desperate. This is the first third of the movie. He decides to unlock her chamber. He decides to wake her up because he's figured it out, which is essentially killing her. Because she's not going to live to see that planet.
Because it's going to take about 90 or 100 years to get to the new Earth.
Right. So when he does that, he's going to get a companion, but they're going to die together. Like, he's taking her life.
Whether she wants to be with him or not, they're dying together.
Right. So he opens it up, and he doesn't tell her. And then the entire second half of the movie is them, like, flirting and dating and then falling in love and then being together. Then finally, when she finds out in the bottom third, another member wakes up. It's Lawrence Fishburne. He's there very briefly. And they have to save the ship. They put it together. She forgives him. They find a way for one of them to go back to sleep. And she forgives him. And they live out their lives happily together. Even though he's basically a space rapist.
That'll be the name of the sequel. Passengers, Space Rapist.
And it's the worst thing, but you forgive him. And even Lawrence Fishburne has a line like, "You know what? Anyone would do this." Right?
Thanks, you're, Morpheus. Shit.
Yeah. If you're a rat, you're going to try to pull down other people, or like pull other people, the crab will pull other crabs out of the pot or whatever, or into the pot.
Oh, jeez.
And it's like,
it's kind of funny when you think that it's Morpheus that's delivering this line. Like, you take the blue pill, or you take Chris Pratt, and you get to have a wonderful adventure.
Oh, we haven't talked about the red pill and people on Reddit like that. And we're just not going to, because I don't want to.
Too much ugly for this episode. Well, I mean,
but it's this hideous thing where, like, he screwed up in a major way, but they just like, "Oh, well, anyone would have done this. You were weak. Men will be men." And
he loves you. And he because loves he you. Because he loves you, that overrides. It's like if a husband rapes his wife, or that the Brock Turner case. He couldn't help himself, and he was just misguided in doing something he didn't realize was wrong. We have to forgive him for it because his intentions were overall good, even though this person was unconscious when he sexually assaulted her.
So speaking, like, again, this segment we're talking just from the male perspective. Like, again, Chris Pratt is who we're pushing as the next Harrison Ford. Who doesn't want to be Chris Pratt?
Right.
Like, he's a super, like, hunky dude. And he's definitely portrayed in this film as like a real man's man, blue collar. He's a mechanic,
mm-hmm.
and she's like a writer.
Yeah.
And.
Well, and we see this in real life when a woman, if a hot guy is making advances at her and she's like, but I'm not interested, people around her will be like, but he's so handsome. Give him a chance. His good looks speak for him, and you'd be a fool to not want to be with a guy like that. If you were to put that in, you know, if the person who was hitting on you wasn't attractive looking, do you think that people would still be cheering them on, or would they be like, ew?
It's the Ryan Gosling effect.
It's the Ryan Gosling
There's
effect.
Some things you can only get away with if you are looking like Ryan Gosling, and you shouldn't be able to, and we shouldn't accept that.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're grooming little girls from a young age to always say yes, or we're forcing our kids to hug and kiss relatives. Like, oh no, give Uncle Joe a kiss. He's here. It's like, no, you want your kids to have these boundaries and be able to say, listen, I'm not interested. I'm not kissing you. And if you push me past that point, you're doing something illegal.
And we're teaching young boys basically to not take no for an answer. Like,
and to not show emotion.
And to not show emotion. And they're not going to be held accountable.
Yeah.
Like, that's what the big message of Passengers really is that men will be men. Anybody in this situation would have done the same thing. Boys will be boys. And so you're not going to be held accountable for this. And what we see in real life is people aren't held accountable for these.
I mean, we saw this recently with the Academy Awards. We have Casey Affleck, who had two former crew members sue him for sexual harassment, and then he settled it out of court. Dude went on to get an Academy Award for his work, and there were no repercussions for this person who allegedly attacked two of his crew members.
I mean, we did this episode because we didn't want to talk about Donald Trump, but you almost have to at this point.
Like, he's a celebrity. He's the first reality TV star to become president, and I still don't understand how we didn't say... First, I don't understand how we didn't say that this guy shouldn't be president when he mocked a person with a disability. But I really don't understand, how did this person get elected after he admitted on tape that sexual assault was fine?
Yeah, so when we see men not being held accountable for these actions on the screen, it does influence our behaviors. Because, like we said, that's where people are getting those social cues from.
These are instruction manuals as much as they are entertainment.
And it really doesn't matter how old you are. Like, this is something that you may have grown up in and just not even realize that it's an issue, because we don't talk about what those abuses look like. So almost more dangerous than what we were talking about in the first segment is what we're talking about in the second segment. You know, there's sometimes it's played for laughs. I do want to mention that fucking scene in Revenge of the Nerds.
Oh God.
Where one of the nerds, I think it's Booger.
No, Booger. It's not Booger.
Okay. One of them straight up rapes a girl by wearing a mask at a party and having sex with her when she...
In the moon, and it's like the moon bounce or the moon room or yeah, something. Exactly. You want to do it on the moon? And he's like, oh, yes, I do.
Yep. And they're having sex, and she thinks it's her boyfriend.
Which I don't understand, because that nerd was not the same body, like, this, not the same physique and not the same height. So I'm like, how do you screw up that bad?
And again, though, like... It's okay because she actually liked it, right?
Yeah.
That makes it okay.
She says, you're one of those nerds. You are amazing. And he's like, thank you.
Right. And she just, like, rolls with it.
Yeah.
That's a horrible message to send to anyone.
Yeah, but it's okay because it turns out he was really good in the sack. And it's like, no.
So.
Also no discussions about protection. Same theme. No protection.
So.
We're not going to answer this tonight, are we?
No, but. Let's just put it real simply, like, gentlemen, you cannot force someone to like you, and you can't just make someone like the kiss in the middle there. Like,
yeah.
There has to be something beforehand.
Like respect, or, you know, respecting boundaries.
Yeah. There's no boundaries. Men are taught in movies to have zero boundaries, and that it's going to work out okay for them.
Yeah. But coming up next, we're going to flip things a little bit and look at who's doing it right, meaning who's showing healthy relationships, and what is a healthy relationship? That's coming up next.
Are you a geek? You looking for a bi-geekly paycheck? Then you should listen to Professional Geek Podcast. We interview geeks who have jobs.
Welcome back.
So we've kind of talked about some pretty heavy topics about abuse, about sexual assault, what is healthy and what isn't. I'm sorry, what's not healthy about the relationships that are being portrayed in movies like 50 Shades of Grey, Passengers, and Twilight.
So we're going to flip this around. We're going to end on a positive note. We're going to talk about some examples of things that we see that we think are really getting it right.
Absolutely. The one thing I want to kind of give us a baseline, there's a group called Break the Cycle, and they had a really great guide for parents and kids called It's Time to Start the Conversation. They mention a couple of different criteria for what a healthy relationship is, and I kind of want to share it really quick. So in a healthy relationship, both partners respect each other's individuality, so one's not saying I can be whatever you want, or one's not changing themselves to appease the other person. Have equal decision-making power, so no contracts. It's just we both are in this for the success of the other. Feel safe being open and honest. Respect each other's boundaries, so no trying to convince somebody that they're going to like it if they just give it a chance. No coercion, no gaslighting. It's just that's how you feel. Your feelings are valid and my feelings are valid too. Let's work together. And finally, and this is pretty important, feel free to share feelings without negative consequences. So no saying you're just being overly sensitive or you'll come around. It's, I'm glad that you brought that to my attention and let's work on that.
So there is one example I really love that I'm going to highlight. And that is the couple Jesse and Celine, played by Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy in Richard Linklater's Before trilogy.
Ah.
Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight. I love this trilogy, and I recommend that everybody see it. It's getting a Criterion release this year. I do recommend if you watch it, spend a little bit of time, like a couple of weeks in between each one, because they're meant to be spaced out. So if you've never watched the Before trilogy, literally they're just three movies of pretty people walking through pretty locations.
And talking about life.
And having conversations, exactly.
Yeah.
We first meet Jesse and Celine when they're in their 20s. It's the early 90s. And they just meet because they both encountered each other on a train and got to talking. And they decide to tour the city of Vienna together because they both happen to be serendipitously going the same direction. And they talk. They go on this extended date, essentially, where they kind of wander around Vienna. It's very nice. And it's not even necessarily romantic. They're just having a very long conversation. And then we see them again in the next movie. It's several years later. This isn't like in the age of Facebook, so they didn't really keep in touch.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse's a little bit successful because he wrote a book off of their story. They meet each other again. And then in the third movie, they're married and they're having like a little bit of issues.
It's fatigue in the relationship.
Yeah, they're tired. And these movies were made because Richard Linklater likes to do this. Several years apart.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, 7 years between the first two and then another 8 or 9 between the second and third. And I realized that not every movie can be this. Obviously, yeah. Not every movie can just be two people talking because it would get really boring mm-hmm. after a while. But Guillermo del Toro tweeted about this series recently, and what he said, I think, was really beautiful. He mentioned that it's a series that shows that it is harder and worthier to live with somebody than to die for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that a lot because one of the other things that we're shown as men is that, like, the sacrifice that men make is they sacrifice themselves, their bodies, or their lives for the women that they're supposed to protect. Whereas when women sacrifice their life, it's usually like a Beauty and the Beast situation where they're literally cutting themselves off. They're sacrificing mm-hmm. their lives, but they still have to live with it.
Yeah, they have to deal with the consequences of making that decision.
If you're doing something romantic like dying for your partner, you're dead. You don't have to deal with that. So that's what I really like. Jesse and Celine are respectful of each other all throughout their relationship. They test each other. They make each other angry. But then they, like, reconcile amicably. It's a really well-developed relationship. So that's my pick. I love the Before trilogy. And I love those people. And it's just so sweet and romantic. And I think they're both very beautiful people.
Right on. Mm. Well, since you get three movies, I'm going to pick two movies.
All right.
First one is Hidden Figures.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That was a wonderful experience. But the icing on the cake for me is Taraji Henson's character is swept off her feet by
Mahershala.
Thank you. It's such a beautiful name, and I wanted to do it justice, so thank you. Mahershala Ali is a guy just gotten out of the army. He's looking to settle down, and it works on so many levels. But what I love is there's a scene where they're washing the dishes. And that's also what's really cool is you don't just see these two characters get it on. They don't hop into bed together and there's beautiful sex where she doesn't have an orgasm, which is, let's be honest, that's how all women are portrayed in these movies. It's the guy getting off and not the girl. But he does.
There's actually an MPAA like ruling about that.
Really?
Like it's been shown that the MPAA tends to go harder on scenes of women.
No pun intended.
On movies that have scenes with women having sexual pleasure for some reason.
Right, or you receiving know. Oral sex.
Or receiving
Forgot
oral sex.
Forgot about that. That's a good point.
Yeah, okay, back to Mahershala.
Right, so he has dinner with her family, and then one night after having dinner, they're doing the dishes. Love this guy. And he's like, well, I reckon I should kiss you now. So he gets permission before going in there for the kiss. He doesn't take what's his. He's like, I want to do this so that you're on board with this.
And it's super sexy when he does it.
It is.
He says, I reckon I should kiss you now. And she, like, plays with it, too. She's like, really? What makes you say that? And then showing that he's picked up on the vibe, showing that he's aware of things, he responds mm-hmm. like, well, if you didn't want this to happen, you would have probably kicked me out a long time ago.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then there's that scene where he asks her to marry him, where the kids are in on it, her mom is in on it, it's a family dinner. And it's not a grand gesture, it's just this is a routine that we've developed, and I want to take this routine to the next level and make it permanent by making you my wife.
And it's super sweet, and in my theater, like, when he puts that casserole down on the table, like, there was a woman behind who just yelled, like, she was super into it.
Oh, my
like,
God.
Like, good for you, man.
And that's the thing.
Let that fly.
Yeah, I mean, with these movies, they lose the gentler elements of getting to know somebody, like, meeting their family, going out to dinner. We have so many men and women in this country who have been married before and may have kids. So showing that a hardworking woman who's a single mom with children is just as desirable as a blonde, single, sexually vivacious woman, I think is very powerful.
And you don't show, or you don't think of Mahershala Ali as any less of a man for any of that. Like, you can't think of Mahershala Ali as less of a man, because that is a man.
That is a man.
Yeah. But
what a man, what a man. Yeah.
But, yeah, and you don't think of him as less of a man for that.
And what's cool also is how their relationship starts. It doesn't start out on a positive note. He's like, oh, you work?
And he kind of insults her.
Yeah, but that's not your place. You're a woman. You're supposed to be at home with the kids. And she's just like, God gave me a brain, and I sure as hell am using it.
But it's not like the Edward Cullen insult, mm-hmm. where it's just like, I'm insulting you, and that's it.
I know it, yeah.
I know it. He backtracks and apologizes and realizes that he did something wrong.
And a similar thing happens with Janelle Monáe's character and her husband. The husband's like, why do you want to go after an engineering degree? You're just going to have the door shut in your face, and they don't want us, meaning black people, to enjoy the same benefits and achievements that they, meaning white people, do. And that scene where she's gone to a judge, she said, I want this degree. The only way I can do it is to go to this all-white school. You guys have rules in place saying I can't go, which means you're effectively preventing me from being able to achieve this education I need to do my job and succeed. Judge says, sure. her husband literally is, he kneels in front of her while she's putting her shoes on, and he's like, I was wrong.
Yeah, he gives her a romantic gift.
Yeah.
He gives her those mechanical pencils. So that she can do it. Which weren't very common in the 60s and probably cost quite a bit.
Yeah.
Now that I think about it.
So to show, and that was a one piece of advice that I had gotten from somebody in a former life where they had said, it's really important if you're a couple that's fighting that you make up, but also if there are kids involved that you make up in front of the kids or in front of other family members or friends who may have witnessed the transgression to show that, you know, this is how a healthy relationship operates. If you're wrong, you admit it. You say, we're going to work on this so that it doesn't happen again, and that our feelings are valid, and then we go on from there.
Now, I will point out that there are a lot of healthy examples of fictional relationships that I've come up with, and we've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we noticed was the vast majority of those relationships are couples who were already married or they were already together at the start of the story.
Yeah.
Like, they've already been together. They're like Eric and Tammy Taylor or Marge and Norm Gunderson in Fargo. Mm-hmm. Like, they're great examples of, like, healthy relationships.
But how did we get to those relationships? We didn't see the backstory.
There aren't as many examples like Taraji P. Henson and Mahershala Ali where we see them get together in a healthy way.
Yeah. Like,
for some reason, we have to skip that in order to get to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Which, I'm glad that you brought that up, because it brings me to my second choice, When Harry Met Sally. Well, and not for the couple that you think. I really dug the relationship between Carrie Fisher's character and Bruno Kirby's character. Mm-hmm. Her character, Carrie Fisher's character in this movie, is a woman who has affairs with married men. Any other movie, there would be slut shaming in a big way. Like, oh, well, you encroach on other women's territories means you have no values, means that you deserve to be raped or you deserve to have bad things done to you because you don't play by the rules. That means no one else should play by the rules with you. Instead, she has these relationships. There comes a point in the movie where she's talking with Meg Ryan and says, like, he's never going to leave his wife. I'm never going to find love with somebody who's already in a relationship with somebody else. Goes on a dinner date with Meg Ryan, Billy Crystal, and Bruno Kirby, and they realize they have a lot in common. She really likes his writing, and they hit it off. They actually get a cab together, and that's the end of it. They're together.
What's great about that scene is both of them ask their friends. Like, both of them are considered, both Carrie Fisher and Bruno Kirby are considerate of their friends' feelings, because
yes,
the date was supposed to be the other way around.
Yeah, Meg Ryan going with Bruno Kirby and Carrie Fisher going with Billy Crystal.
Right. Right. And they both, like, ask each other, like, hey, is it okay? Like, they consider other people's feelings before they just run off together.
Exactly.
And, yeah, I really love that relationship. I love that we kind of see them jump stages, so we don't see a whole lot of their relationship, but they seem to work really well together.
Mm-hmm.
I also like Harry and Sally.
Yeah.
Like, Harry and Sally are a good couple. I feel like a lot of people misunderstand that relationship.
Yeah.
Chuck Klosterman wrote a bit in Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs 10, 15 years ago, where he talks about how he feels that Nora Ephron probably ruined a lot of lives because every guy who's pining after his best friend is like, oh, we'll fall in love later. It'll be like When Harry Met Sally. But they're completely missing the point of When Harry Met Sally. And I think so is Chuck Klosterman.
Yeah. And there's that comes with that male entitlement idea of, well, because I love you or because I'm attracted to you and I want to fuck you, that means that I deserve to have you and you should be mine and you should acquiesce to my demands.
Because I'm good. Because I'm good enough. Right? I'm a good guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, eventually this will happen.
Yeah.
Right?
If you're a good person, good things will happen to you too.
Right. And you're going to get what you deserve in form of romantic or sexual validation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what happens in When Harry Met Sally.
Nope.
When Harry Met Sally is basically like two people who have a very, very strong bond for their friendship, but that developed for years. And also, they don't like each other at the beginning of the movie either.
Oh, yeah. He thinks that she's very stuck up and opinionated. And
she hates him.
Yeah.
They, like, develop this eventually. Like, I guess if you were going to criticize it, you could say that she's kind of vulnerable that first moment that they hook up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's coming off that breakup and they just kind of fall into bed together. I don't read it that way.
Yeah.
So I do think that the plot of Harry Met Sally isn't your best friend will fall in love with you because you're secretly meant to be together. Mm-hmm. That's not the plot of that movie. In fact, the whole screenplay has people, old people talking about falling in love at first sight all the way through there. It's more that like relationships are different and some relationships work best when you have just a very solid basis of friendship first.
Right. And what's interesting is I have a lot of friends who met their husbands and wives because it was a hookup. It started as a hookup and it was a sexual thing. But for whatever reason, it blossomed into romance. So
a 370 night stand.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. But I think we need more movies that not only show healthy relationships, but show that there's nothing wrong, you shouldn't kink shame, there's nothing wrong with somebody who sleeps around with several different partners, finding love eventually, or finding love through a casual hookup.
You know, I'm going to give another shout out to Dakota Johnson from 50 Shades of Grey. She was in a film last year called How to Be Single.
Mm-hmm.
And How to Be Single is remarkable because it doesn't, like, shame anybody for casual sex.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two characters, her and I think his name is Anders Holm, one of the workaholics, who are friends, and they hook up, and then they don't get together at the end of the movie. All that happens is she finds somebody else, or she kind of gets happy being single, and he starts to consider, maybe I do want something more. Not with her, but just in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was kind of a remarkable way to see that. Like, these two people are friends, and they are just friends that happen to fall together one time. They don't have the Harry Met Sally thing. How to Be Single is a way better movie than it had any right to be. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up because it brings us to another point, which is there's nothing wrong with being single. You're not lesser of a man. You're not lesser of a woman. You're not a less valued member of society if you decide not to get married or you don't find the love of your life in your 20s and you don't have children.
Before we close out, we've talked about movies that are mostly aimed at teens and young adults.
And adults.
And adults, even some older adults in there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go real basic. Let's go to the youths, as it were.
The kids.
Let's talk about some Disney movies.
Which is interesting because I think people were kind of on Disney's case for many years about perpetuating harmful stereotypes about relationships, like girls needing to be rescued, or in the case of a movie that's about to be remade and released in a couple of weeks, Beauty and the Beast.
Which, by the way, also has that, like, man sacrifices himself by dying thing.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, but I mean, with that movie, I loved that movie as a kid. I loved that movie so much. And now I'm looking back at it as an adult, like, why did I think it was okay that a girl gives up her freedom to live in this house with a beast forever? But apparently in the new one, Emma Watson would only sign on to do this movie under condition that some of those glaring issues were addressed and that Belle had more agency.
They are, like, opening up a whole new realm of issues based on, like, their treatment of LeFou. Mm-hmm. And again, I can't make a huge call because I haven't seen the movie yet. I kind of don't want to see the movie because it looks like garbage.
What? I think it looks cool. Oh, it's got Dan Stevens as the Beast.
Those character designs look hideous.
I guess we'll find out when it comes out in a few weeks. But other Disney movies that are getting it right.
And let's also not say, like, Beauty and the Beast is a great movie.
It has
some weird issues, just that, and also pertain to other things, but Beauty and the Beast is wonderful, and there's really nothing wrong with, like, watching and loving Beauty and the Beast.
Right, so long as you recognize it's not okay to be mean to somebody and then put up with it because you think that they're going to change.
You can't fix them. Nope. You can't fix the Beast.
The Beast will not turn into a charming prince. Your candelabras will not talk to you. They will not serve you dinner. Just get with it.
Okay, so, but more recently, these films have kind of taken a different tone.
Mm-hmm. Like Frozen.
Let's talk about Frozen. Frozen flat out says, do not marry the first person you see.
Do not marry Prince Charming.
Do not marry a man you just met. Especially since, like, Anna has a limited connection to the world. Anna's been sheltered this mm-hmm. whole time. And the guy that she's falling for, Hans, is a prince.
Yeah.
It's very much like Anastasia Steele and Christian Grey.
Mm-hmm.
He's wealthy. He's been experienced. He's seen most of the world. He has way more experience in life than she does. So it makes it easy for her to take advantage of him. No, other way around. It makes it easy for him to take advantage of her.
Right. And that's a key element in those abusive relationships, again, is one person having dominance or control over the other.
So the movie does end with her, not with Hans, but with Christoph.
Right. But even more importantly, the love story that's at the center of Frozen is not a prince and a girl. It's a sister and her sister.
The reason I brought up her being with Christoph at the end is, like, the last lines of the movie are a very cute moment where he, like, stumbles over himself and is like, I would like to kiss you now. This would be a good thing, kissing. And then they kiss.
Yeah, so he gets permission.
He does. And it's true, like, that's not the focus of the movie, though. That's kind of periphery.
Yeah.
It's between the two sisters. Moana doesn't even have a romantic interest.
That's right.
Right.
It does have a cool sea turtle, though.
It does have a cool sea turtle.
And then there's Tangled.
Tangled, where we do know that Flynn and Rapunzel do marry, but they're not married at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
They start dating, basically, at the end of the movie. And we're told that, like, a long, long time later, they do get married.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, and plus, all of these women that we just talked about, Anna and Moana and Rapunzel,
mm-hmm.
they're all characters in their own right. In fact, the men are kind of secondary roles in
mm-hmm.
these.
They're independent, they have agency, they make decisions, they have weaknesses, they have strengths.
Whereas this previous princess movies kind of went back and forth.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Aurora, we'll talk back to Sleeping Beauty, which also brings us back to Passengers.
Mm-hmm.
That's not her story.
No.
That's Prince...
Prince Philip.
Prince Philip's story.
Yeah.
Really, it's more... Maleficent. It's more Maleficent story than anything. But
and then they made a movie about it, which even that had a whole instance of
that had such sexual
assault overtones. Yeah,
super sexual assault overtones in that one. And we're talking about this mainly because this starts young.
Yeah,
our ideas of these social cues that Jess talked about way at the beginning. Those start forming way younger than we ever imagined.
Yeah, and kids do pick up on a lot of the things that we talk about. What's interesting, last year a friend of mine was telling me about this one particular instance where her son was playing Minecraft, and the way their house is set up, the computer is in the family room where mom and dad can be around and can kind of not snoop or be helicopter parents, but they're aware of what's going on. So... son's playing on Minecraft, and he's playing with his friends. They're online as well, and they're talking through microphones and stuff like that. Suddenly, one of the friends says, we're going to rape everybody in this village. And, you know...
because that's a term, right?
Exactly.
Like, me raping you just means that I'm beating you in this game.
Exactly, but in this case, he meant, I think they were playing a game where the object was to divide and conquer villages and stuff like that, so he's like, I'm gonna rape every girl in this village.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so suddenly the son is like, whoa, do you understand what you just said? And from the other room, my friend and her husband, she's like, oh my god, I have to go in there and stop this, and he's like, let's see how he handles this, and sure enough, the son is like, that's not okay. Do you know what that even means? Like, he actually stops the kid and says, I want you to learn from this. Do you know what this means? And the kid on the other end who said the offending statement's like, I thought it was just when you lie naked in a bed with a girl. And he's like, no, that's when you force a girl to have sex with you. That's evil and wrong. And we don't joke about that. And my friend's in the other room. She's just like, oh my God, we raised him right. So, I mean, it is possible to start those behaviors young just by saying, like I mentioned with my 12-year-old nephew earlier, if somebody says they don't want to play a game, if somebody says that they're uncomfortable with something that you're doing, you let them know that their feelings are valid, and you move on to something else.
Yeah, kids are smarter than we give them credit for, and kids might actually be better at telling fantasy from reality than adults are.
Absolutely. I wouldn't disagree.
And that's why we have these conversations when we talk about, like, stuff aimed at children. So things aimed at children probably should be scrutinized more heavily, and I've always believed that. Than work aimed at adults.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go ahead and wrap this up.
I think that's a good... So, thanks for listening. I'm Marta Russick.
I'm Martin R. Schneider. Please listen and subscribe. Share the podcast. You can now reach us on iTunes. You can listen to us at frontrowcentral.com/podcasts, as well as any podcast catcher of your choice. Please rate, please review. It'll help other people find us, and it'll be wonderful for everybody involved. You can find me online on Twitter at @SchneidRemarks. You can follow us on Twitter at @PolyTheaterCast. That's at @PoLi TheaterCast. And you can find Marta.
You can find Marta, me, at @MartaRussick on Twitter. That's our podcast. Thanks for listening.